Right, I'm going to buzz through to him now, mate.
Cool.
It's ringing.
Hello?
Hello, yes, right.
Hello.
Hey there, mother. To a history of misunderstanding, I am Smokey.
And I'm Stephen.
And how the fuck are you, sir?
I'm very happy to be welcoming two excellent guests.
Yes, we'll get onto them shortly, jumping the gun as always. But happy episode 43.
Happy episode to you.
Yes, it's been a long time coming.
That's what she said.
I know, lucky girl that she is as well. But yes, as you mentioned there, we have once again been joined. Oh, dear and valued listeners. They're back. It's Scotland and Charles of the wonderful Stinking Paws. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
I should have prefaced that with the very talkative Scotland and Charles from the Stinking Paws.
Sure.
Yeah.
I set them up and you knocked them out of the park.
No, he chases them around.
So if any of our listeners are stupid enough not to have listened to the Stinking Paws, do you want to throw them a brief thing on what you are and what you do?
Charlie, I'll let you do that, mate.
Right. We're a classic movie podcast. That's the movie's not classic, not quality of podcasting. What we tend to do is we look at films that are over 10 years old and we kind of use it as an opportunity to fill in any gaps that we might have in our sort of classic repertoire, to be honest.
Yeah, Space Jam was a big gap filler there, wasn't it?
Massive. I can't believe Scott hadn't seen it. Disgraceful.
He's never watching it again either, that's for sure.
That was an anomaly, really, because normally there's a kind of educating Charlie aspect to the show. It's become gradually more and more that actually Charlie is bringing things for Scott as well, so that's quite a nice development that you've had.
Yeah, it's working out well for the pair of us, actually, because Charlie's sort of discovering things off his own bat now, so to speak. He's bringing me stuff that I should have seen, you know, being the classic film fan that I am. But, you know, just through the sheer number of movies out there, I've never got round to watching them. And it's great. It's actually great to actually discover some stuff that, you know, is worth watching.
It's nice that you can plug each other's holes then in that way.
Always.
So, whose suggestion was Walkabout?
That was mine.
Oh, really? So anything to do with the naked Jenny Agutter in that?
Well, yeah, there is the element of the bush in the bush, so to speak. But I hadn't seen the film for 20, 30 years, so it's just another excuse for me to rewatch a great movie. Well, I'm hoping it's going to be great. I remember it being great, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, it got me thinking, especially after what we're about to discuss later in this episode, you've just got a lot of naked women going to be on your TV soon.
It is frightening because I've just set up this home cinema system at home now, and I watched the movie in question last night on an 8-foot by 4-foot screen in my living room, and boy was it good. It was a great film.
Do you measure it now in numbers of boxes of tissues?
No comment.
Take the fifth.
Oh, well, I'll plead the fifth on that. Yeah.
I'm sure he took more than five. But there you go.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we will come on to the film we all watched recently. Oh, don't say it. We will eventually arrive. Now, hang on. There's no way I can say that without being dirty. We will get there eventually. If we are sticking with the usual show format, then we really should hasten on, though, to our thank yous.
Yes.
By listening to the following, you are supporting the Pod Pals Independent Podcasters. Thank you!
Just so we don't bore these two very much, do we have very much to discuss this time?
Not a lot, no.
Good. No one's talking to us. Fantastic.
One of the obvious correspondents that we usually have, Mr. Robbie Polanco.
Who?
Never heard of him.
No, he never gets in touch with us anyway.
He's a stranger to us all.
I know.
He merely let us know about the last episode to say, I'll give Chinese Zodiac a chance because Jackie Chan is fantastic.
Well, he's right about that. As we said, it wasn't a classic Jackie Chan film, but it was entertaining.
He's letting Jackie Chan in, is the case.
Shouldn't we all?
And also we had a message from Andrew at the Weekly Geek Speak, who actually tried to do a public service announcement to people that he shouldn't be listening to our show and shaving at the same time. He ended up having to dip into his Spider-Man plasters in order to cover over his cuts.
But how are we getting the blame for that? What did we do?
It was a public service announcement warning people. It wasn't our fault. It was just warning people that, you know, don't wet shave and listen to us at the same time.
Okay, so, fair enough.
I assume he was laughing, but you never know with Andrew.
Not with our show. No. Thank you, Bobby and Andy. That's very kind
of you. So that's it for our correspondences.
Oh, it's very brief. There was just a little brief one I'd like to speak about on the latest edition of the Urge Ridgecast. It was episode 104, if I remember rightly. He had two people that Scotland and Charles Enno, as well as us. They had Tom and Joe on their show. It was very nice to hear them both. It was very nice to hear Joe being very strict and Tom going along with everything she said. But they threw out a little gentle ribbing our way.
Did they?
They did. Oh. They did, yeah. About our recording schedule and how lax we are with it.
Well, yes. Mm. That's true that the schedule has kind of dropped off.
Well,
but then, you know, we try to make sure we've got enough acts in our show to actually make a complete show. I'm just make things up.
Yeah. And also with our three-letter acronym of our podcast, it's in the right order.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Tommy did say that I had a face for radio, bless him, but hey, you know, at least I have a voice for podcasting, but not all of us can be nice.
He's absolutely right about the face.
Well, yeah, that's fine, but you know, never mind the voice, but that's good. But yeah, so a very lean one this year, but this episode, I don't know where that came from. So yes, but we can leave those thank yous over there. We might as well hasten on to our recent watches.
A History of Misunderstanding presents some short reviews.
So I think we should let Guest go first, sir. What do you think?
Why not? Yes.
So, Scotland, Charlie, who would like to go first on a recent watch?
I think Charlie's going to be a bit more highbrow than mine, so I think we'll let Charlie go with it.
I don't know about highbrow, but I think it's certainly fitting the kind of film that we're going to be discussing. And 2 weeks ago, I watched Eraserhead for the first time. I've really wanted the opportunity to speak about it either on this or our own podcast, because it is really one of those films that just demands discussion. And I still don't really know what to make of it, other than the fact that it was fucked up and I loved it.
It's a film I haven't seen for a very long time.
No, I mean,
and it does cause a bit of scattering in your brain, and to be honest, your reaction to it, I think, tends to change the more you think about it. So I'd be interested to hear what your overall opinion was, to be honest.
Mm. I mean, I've been watching a few David Lynch things lately, and that's been brought on by the fact that Twin Peaks is coming back next year, and I want to get his catalogue sort of watched, basically, so I know what to expect from the new series. And I just find it extraordinary, really, that this man was asked to make The Elephant Man on the strength of this film, really. You can see some visual connections there, but in terms of the tone and the topic, there really isn't a more sort of outlandish kind of film when compared to The Elephant Man to think of.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Eraserhead more shows a competency and a skill with cinema, and to be able to get these things shot rather than actually there being a stylistic comparison between the two, because as you say, they're diametrically different in the way that they are shot, which I think has a lot to do with the nature of the story, but I think also because David Lynch likes to just continue to be doing things that interest him that are newer, and he doesn't necessarily feel the need to hammer away doing the same thing again and again. He's got some tricks and stuff that are signatures of his, but I think The Elephant Man interested him because of the subject matter and actually proving himself that he could actually make a more straight film, as it were.
Yeah.
But it's great that they actually has those two in his early career to be able to point at as the scope of what he can do, really.
It is an incredible fucked up movie, though.
Yes, absolutely,
Just to bring the brow lower a little bit, it is messed in the head, that film.
I think I put on Facebook that I'd watched it for the first time, and Tom actually commented on it, and he was quite succinct in what he said, that it was really disturbing, and yet he was compelled by it. He couldn't turn it off. You know, we had this debate about the word enjoy when we were talking about Irreversible. It's that same kind of thing. You like it, you're gripped by it, but to use the term enjoy would seem quite weird in this instance.
Very much so. Would you class it as a horror movie?
It's horrifying.
Yeah, it's more nightmarish, isn't it, than kind of, I don't know. I think it was more because it was visceral that I was disturbed by. It was like the visual kind of grittiness of it, rather than anything actually happening that made me jump out of my seat or gave me nightmares. It's just it's a very engaging but disturbing watch.
Yeah, I just whenever I sort of read things about Eraserhead or see the sort of debate that rages on, that's the question that sort of gets brought up the most. Is it, would you class it as a horror movie? And I think it'll always divide opinion on it. But I mean, maybe there just should be a horrifying category for it.
Yeah, because I think it's too good to be a horror movie. Because
generally,
there's a trend for horror movies to actually dumb down and go for a lot more basic terror in it and the gore and such in modern times. And I think, as we discussed before, there are some things that could more accurately be described as being horror films, but not fit with what modern horror is. And this is one that I think fits within that. Mm-hmm. That it's a horror film in maybe the purest sense of it. It's not a monster fest same way that, you know...
Psychological horror.
Well, this is it, which tends to be the ones that actually work as horror films, in my opinion, rather than the ones that do rely upon
the blood and guts.
The blood and guts, and then repeating that for 7 films.
Well, yeah, okay, fair enough, yeah. Yeah, so did you give it a rating, Charlie?
I actually gave it 5 stars. I was that impressed by it because it's just one of those films that you'll always remember your initial reaction to it. Some films are good, but eventually they become kind of lost in your memory, whereas I think this is something that's going to stay with me. And as you rightfully mentioned, Stephen, it's like the craft of Lynch is really impressive. I think he really comes across as an auteur that early in his career with this. And that's no mean feat.
No, not at all. I mean, I've only seen a few Lynch films that I can really remember, but that one and Blue Velvet as well have really stuck in my head for a long time.
That's another fantastic film, Blue Velvet, which I also watched recently.
And what did you think of that?
Yeah, brilliant. Dennis Hopper's performance is extraordinary. Oh, that scene in particular.
Wants to fuck. That's so hot.
Bella Rossellini is... I've never seen anything like that, to be honest. Just, again, it's that kind of thing where you don't enjoy it, but it stays with you, and that in itself makes it a great piece of work.
It does, yeah. I don't think I've seen a Lynch movie that isn't a hard watch, but I do. I think they all... And most of them end up being rewarding watches, though.
Yeah, so, bring on Twin Peaks when it comes back.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Me as well. I mean, I remember watching it the first time around when it was on the television and then seeing some of it on some form of, I don't know if it was on repeat or somebody had it on DVD, but I watched some of it again a while later on and realised that my memory of it actually was not doing it a good enough service,
to be
honest. So
it stands out.
So, a lot of the time, sometimes you can look back on things and remember it to be better than they actually were, but in this case it was, I'd enjoyed it first time around and then watching it again was finding it was actually a lot better.
Outstanding. That's great. Thank you very much, Charlie. Right, we will chop and change, so we'll throw it over to you, Stephen. What's your first recent watch?
My most recent watch that I'm going to mention is Million Dollar Baby from 2004.
Clint
Eastwood directing and starring along with Morgan Freeman and Hilary Swank. What are you laughing at?
Has to be done.
It's definitely an earnestly formed piece from the cast, you know, portraying this plot centering around the rise of this female boxer in a rundown gym that's actually being run by an even more rundown boxing promoter. The performances are, I think, good, which you would expect because, you know, Morgan Freeman, Clint Eastwood, and Hilary are also known for doing good performances. I think as a film it was really a tedious drag for me to watch.
Oh really?
Yeah, it sort of had about half an hour plot spread over 2 hours, which is, you know, beyond our usual discussions about European pacing to move into something more glacial in its pacing, to be honest. It just felt devoid of entertainment for me.
Wow.
Any chance of any joy from it I could get was just given a knockout blow, you know, halfway through with the way the story turned, and then it was just a depressing second half towards a limp and bleak ending. And I mean, I'm not a boxing fan anyway, but it just felt dire to watch. It was a real struggle to get through, and I'm glad I've watched it since it's got a reputation it does have, but it just left me thinking it's highly overrated and that this grizzled old fella act that Clint Eastwood seems to continue doing now, where he's just...
Well, he is a grizzled old man, that's all he can do.
But it just seems like he's just plummeting into this depths of just being this one-dimensional character, unfortunately, in the films that he directed. And I couldn't find any joy in it, and I think that it felt a lot longer than it actually was to watch it.
Wow. This doesn't happen very often. It's actually quite rare, but I have to say I completely disagree with everything you just said. That's shocking.
You don't think the acting's good?
I think, not everything you said, but most of it. But I think it's a fantastic film. If I had to rate it quickly straight away, I'd at least give it an 8. I think it's plotted out really well. I think the script's awesome. It looks fantastic. The sort of the black and white and shading that they're using in the film is great. I do get your point about the ending. That's very tough to watch, and it does shift very severely, sort of three quarters way through. But I've seen that a few times, and it's gripped me every time. I think it's a wonderful piece of work.
No, it didn't grip me at all. It just felt like a real chore. It was like wading through quicksand to try and get through it. It was.
Blimey.
I mean, it took me three times to be able to get through it all together, and I did actually start from the beginning each time, so I wasn't, you know, giving it a disservice. And the first time around, watching it with Joe to begin with, and we both really couldn't stomach it for more than a short amount of time before we just found it so incredibly tedious that we had to go and do something less boring instead, as the TV series used to say.
My word. Scott, Charlie, have you seen the film?
Yeah, I remember enjoying it, same as you, Smokey. I've only seen it the once. I went into it blind, so I didn't know what that dramatic, you know, plot development was going to be halfway through the movie. So that really got me when that actually happened.
Yeah, I didn't know that was how the turn it was going to take. And when it did, it took a downturn for me. I thought, you know, it wasn't necessarily going that far in the first place. And then it took that downturn, and I just felt it was a further negative for it.
Yeah, I think the most surprising thing about it, it actually won Best Picture Oscar, didn't it, that year, I think?
Yes, it did. Yeah, I think she won the Actress Oscar as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good movie. I liked it.
Yeah, me too. Charlie, have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. It's one of those ones I've never really been compelled to watch. It just doesn't stand out as something that I need to get to right away. But I will eventually, particularly because it won her Best Picture. I'm not the biggest boxing fan either, but I do like punching women, so... I think that will probably be one of the reasons why I eventually catch up with it.
Andy Capp was his hero. Oh, fair enough. So do we have a rating from you, Steve? Just don't bother?
If you're particularly into really long, drawn-out boxing films, which have a rather pressing ending, then up on a streaming service. But otherwise, if it had been shorter, I'd suggest it's one that maybe people give a go for themselves to, you know, find out why my opinion is so in opposition to you in Scotland. But it's such a long film that I really couldn't advise anybody going out their way unless they felt a particular pull towards it, because it's a massive chunk of their life to be taken up for a film which I really don't think deserves that amount of time. So I'd say one to just avoid, to be honest.
Fair enough. I mean, that's, you know, films are subjective just like everything else.
Just one thing I wanted to ask, actually. Like, do you ever feel like if something's won Best Picture or it has that much acclaim, it can sometimes have an adverse effect when you go into watching it?
Well, I mean, they're not infallible, as we all know, the Oscars and everything. I mean, let's put it this way. You've got to remember that also Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture, so you've got to take it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a rather negative attitude towards the Oscars anyway. I do consider it to be very biased, and it represents a certain demographic of a few hundred rich white men, and that's really as far as it goes. So I don't take against something on principle just because it's got good notice from the Oscars. I do have certain characteristics in me which have sort of reverse classism and
what?
Things like this.
You?
But when it comes to the Oscars, I just decide to just completely ignore what their point of view is and treat it in my own right, because sometimes they're right and a lot of the time they're not. So
yeah. Also, if I remember rightly, Chicago's won Best Picture as well, so that's further proof for you.
I know Scotland is a fan of actually taking the night off work to go and watch it, and I mean it's not that he's fan without criticism of it. He's you know, he can criticise it as well as others can, but I know he does have a wider view of it as being part of the industry and part of film culture.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that people who like the Oscars are, you know, twats.
I just enjoy the whole overblown spectacle of the thing and blowing smoke up each other's
dresses, don't you?
No, I'm not there for the old catwalk and the handbags. It's just the fact that there's all these people still, like, since 1927 when the first Oscars ceremony was, you know, inaugurated, they're still blowing smoke up each other's arses. Why don't they just stand there, present the bloody awards and get on with it? That was a good film. There's your Oscar. It just fascinates me that they can stretch this whole process out to a 3.5-hour show for a dozen awards. It's just incredible.
It is complete bollocks, isn't it, when you think about it? Like, it's, I'm going to take a selfie with Ellen DeGeneres. Fuck off.
Yeah, she just wanted to be in that picture because she wasn't a celebrity. There you go.
that Tank Girl quote, isn't it? The preposterous, tensious bollocks of the situation. So, yeah, I can understand the interest in it and that, you know, Scotland has this more critical view of it and he's not actually just lapping it up as just been somebody who goes, oh, the Oscars, oh, it must be good enough. No, he's
no, he does that when we're not talking to
well,
him.
Yeah. But, yeah, he was talking about his handbag and his catwalk. But...
Paints himself gold.
Oh, God.
Except his heel. Don't want to suffocate.
Nice reference.
So, yeah, I try not to be a contrarianist about the Oscars.
Track must be a cunt.
No, I can't ever have been accused of not trying not to be a cunt. No. But the Oscars, I think, you know, for me, is something I just try to put aside completely, and whatever the Oscars view of a film is, I'll make up my own mind.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah.
And I'm not too egotistical to be able to acknowledge it, that the Oscars get it right occasionally.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at what I just said a few minutes ago, right? I mean, I was slagging off Shakespeare in Love. Now, I didn't think it was a terrible movie, but it certainly isn't a best picture in my mind. But there was obviously enough people who voted for the fucking thing to get it up there, so everyone's different, aren't they? So
Wasn't that the same year as Saving Private Ryan?
Was it?
I think so.
Was it like 97?
96, 97. I think it was the same year as Private Ryan.
At least Titanic. I mean, fucking it.
I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Saving Private Ryan, as you know, but it shits all over Shakespeare in Love.
Saving Private Ryan was actually 98 and Shakespeare in Love was 97, but that doesn't necessarily mean there weren't contenders at the same time.
Yeah, it depends on when they're released, doesn't it?
They released it, yeah.
Fair enough. But, yeah, excellent. So, fuck Clint Eastwood and fuck the Oscars. Well done, Stephen. So, we will throw it over to Scott. What's been your recent watch?
Well, I can guarantee we're not going to spend too long on this one. This does not deserve any critical analysis whatsoever, but it's a bit of a sad indictment that this is actually my film of the year so far. About 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I went and saw San Andreas with Dwayne Johnson.
Oh, God.
My word.
Anyway, so moving on.
Honestly, it's...
Can I just say, before you go on, Scott, I'm sorry, can I just say, wasn't it last time you brought Noah to the table?
Yes, and that was fucking awful as well. That was absolute pants, that film. This one, I'm gonna be bold here. I enjoyed this more than Jurassic World, right? It's the first film I've ever seen with Dwayne Johnson in it, which is, you know, no great boast, actually. Paul Giamatti, absolutely fantastic, does what he's asked to do, he plays the expert. I mean, Taylorson would have loved this movie. You know, he likes a disaster movie, as we know. You've got eye candy of Carla Gugino and Alexandra Daddario in it. It all added to the whole spectacle of the thing. And the special effects, the CGI, has come up leap and bounds in the last sort of 10 years. When, was it 2012 came out and The Day After Tomorrow or whatever it was? You had that whole spate of them, didn't we, about 10 years ago?
Yeah.
The improvement in the quality of buildings crashing is absolutely fantastic, and tsunamis and things like that. And as I say, it was just 2 hours of switch your brain off, and I'm going to use that phrase that we used last time. It was balls out entertainment. I loved it.
You know Charlie doesn't like you using that phrase.
I know. I'd only whisper it to in his ear normally, so.
It implies that you had a wank.
That's what we call stinking paws pillow talk.
But yeah, it's, to be honest, I haven't seen the Avengers movie. I've got superhero overload. I'm you know, just putting those on the back burner now.
Yeah, I mean, same on our last episode about I've got this superhero fatigue.
Yeah,
and I haven't seen Boyhood this year, or is it Nightcrawler? You know, the more critically acclaimed ones that will probably should be film of the year for me. Unfortunately, my choice of films has meant that San Andreas, at the moment, is my movie of the year.
My word.
That's a massive shot. Did you actually prefer it to Whiplash?
Oh, hang on, I did see Whiplash. No, actually, yeah, I did. I preferred it to Whiplash.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, it's weird. It just did everything that it was designed to do, which was to keep me entertained for 2 hours. I loved it. Absolutely great
film.
Balls out.
I mean, all jokes aside, I probably wouldn't enjoy it if I watched it, but it's a bit like you're saying with the Oscars, Stephen. It's like I try not to be too much of a snob about these things. And, you know, these films have a place. I just don't like the fact that we're saturated with them, really. I think that's my issue.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like, you know... we've said about a number of films, that we can recognise that they aren't great films in themselves, but they fill that niche of sometimes you just want to watch a film that is switched your brain off and is just just crashing about in front of you. Now, admittedly, we often go for a Jackie Chan film, when we want that. Yeah. But there's plenty of other films that do have that out-and-out
stupidity.
I mean, you know, that's why I like Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, don't mention The Rock.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I mean, as Charlie said, it's the saturation with them, and you feel a bit of a reaction against it because you feel like it's a dumbing down of cinema, that they're just pumping these things out which are just
shite.
I mean, yeah, it's not only that they're shite, but it's not uncommon for you to find the basic idea for a film that there's a number of them that come out at the same time, and like all that White House Down and Olympus Has Fallen and all this kind of stuff. And you get every couple of years, you get a series of films, like two films out in the same year that are more or less the same film, and they're not really saying much more than just being a flashbang on the screen. And you're thinking, why do we need two of them?
Yeah, that's true. I need to ask a very important question to you, though, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning Eye Candy, but I failed to hear the mention of one of the most beautiful women on the planet who's in that film, there's a cameo from Kylie Minogue.
I know, I just remembered it. I've just quickly flicked this up on IMDb and saw her sitting there. I completely forgot she was in it. Yeah, there you go. That just raises you up another half star, you know.
I was going to say, it's a very little known fact of mine that I actually love Kylie Minogue. Not a big fan of her music, but just her in general. So I probably would have paid just to see her, to see it just for her, basically.
My question is, did you go to see it round about the same time there were the earthquakes around your part of the country? Because I seem to recall Dwayne The Rock Johnson being doing some media junket around that time and commenting about the earthquakes, you know, that he'd come around and then there was earthquakes, you know, coincidental and all this kind of stuff. And he didn't actually appreciate the difference between earthquakes elsewhere in the world where he comes from and earthquakes over here.
It was about the same time.
Kermode, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. We're not getting into the Kermode thing again. We're not. So do we have a rating for San Andreas, Scotland?
At the moment, if we're using the Stinking Paul's star rating, it's 4.5 out of 5.
Bloody hell. That surprises me.
But on the criteria, it does exactly what it says on the tin.
Yes, yeah. It's just entertainment. That's the only way I can describe it. It entertained me perfectly for 2 hours.
I can't mock you for that, because I'll tell you why. It was day before yesterday, I rewatched 3 Days to Kill again. Yeah. The Kevin Costner action bollocks. And that is so ridiculous that it is just pure entertainment. It's taken with a sense of humour, basically. And I loved every single second of it because it was just fun shit.
Yeah.
And everyone loves a fun shit every now and again.
Need to rewatch that.
My only...
Oh, you saw...
The use of Bread's music probably annoyed me a bit, but other than that, it was a way. It was a perfect example of what we're talking about, really.
Exactly. I thought that's why I'd bring it up. But it was just so enjoyable, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to go into it. It's not... People were going into that film thinking it was an action movie because of, you know, the Luc Besson, you know, associations and Kevin Costner being billed in this big action role. If you take a step back and look at the comedic elements of it and just take that on board, it just raises the film to another level. It is a fantastic film. I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, wow, 4.5 for San Andreas. I'm...
That can change. That can change. On my second viewing, you know, it will probably go down. I'm quite happy to reevaluate movies all the time.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because last time we recorded on your show, you gave Four Weddings 5 out of 5.
Did I?
Yeah, you'd had half a bottle of vodka and gave it 5 out of 5.
Now, even in the cold light of day, thinking about that statement, you've got to take at least 1.5 stars off of that evaluation, for God's sake.
Yeah. You do.
Mate,
I hope you have since the taken it down.
I'm gonna have to watch that again tonight, I'll let you know.
On your massive TV.
On my massive TV.
Oh no, can you imagine it? He's got that huge TV now, the size of Andy McDowell's moustache is gonna be fucking huge. Right. Well,
Tom Selleck's gonna be jealous.
Bless him. Andy McDowell is Magnum PI. No. 3 men and a hair lip. No. Right. Okay. Serious now. Serious professional. Right. If we had been going in, say, a different order of reviewing these films, I would be about to say, I was going to say that I'm going to bring the tone down a lot now, but Scott's just done that. Believe it or not, I am going to bring the tone down very far, because I am going to talk about the film I watched, which was the year 2000 movie Cruel Intentions 2.
Oh my god. Oh, yeah.
There is a reason for this, and I will come to you shortly. Directed...
You lost all your partners.
They're safely hidden away. Directed by Roger Cumble and starring...
Roger who? Sorry?
I don't know why I watched this. Starring Amy Adams, Robin Dunn, Sarah Thompson, and who gives a fuck? Right, so... saw the first Cruel Intentions. Obviously, it was a teen version of... what was it called? The Dangerous Liaisons. And... that was fine. It wasn't really for me. It was for a teen thing. Now, I can neither confirm nor deny if the pure reason that I watched Cruel Intentions 2 was that it had Amy Adams in when she wasn't well known and in a series of revealing outfits, including a school uniform and horse riding clothes. Can't confirm nor deny that's why I watched this at all. But it was, and she did, and it was awesome. this is an absolutely dreadful film.
Really?
Yeah.
What a chance of that.
Just bear with me, right? This is a bit convoluted, but I'll get there in a sec. So it was going to, literally, it was going to be maybe a 2, I think. I think I would have pushed it for a 2 or a 3, just because of the lovely Miss Adams inclusion. However, watched it, absolute pile of shit. Didn't really give a fuck, right? But then I actually read up on it. Now, this was originally filmed as it was going to be a prequel TV show to the original Cruel Intentions.
Right.
They made one episode and it got cancelled without being shown. So they decided to turn it into a prequel. So they filmed...
So it wasn't good enough to be a half-hour TV show.
No, well,
so
no,
they decided to make a film out of it.
Yeah, that was 87 minutes long. Right. So what they did was they went back, they filmed extra scenes, threw in a load more exposition, and threw in a lot more, sex that wouldn't have been allowed on TV, right? So that you know, the sort of the nudity level pushes it up an extra, you know, star, if you will. But
I won't.
What I've got, I know this is going to sound really strange. I've got to give this film a lot of credit, right? Because they knew they'd been cancelled. They knew they were making a dreadful patchwork version of a film. And they threw in loads of jokes, loads of in-jokes about them being cancelled and being a terrible movie. It was so knowing that it actually started to impress me after I'd watched it. It was really strange. So, as I said, on its own, it was awful. But with a bit of backstory and a bit of research, it actually went up a bit in my estimation.
Well, admittedly, you're not a well man at the moment.
Well, no, that's true. That's true. I do have, you know, many crippling mental problems. But it was... It actually impressed me with how they dealt with the sort of crushing blow of not being on TV. And they still made a really bad film, but it knew it was a bad film and it took the piss out of itself. I wondered why bits weren't making any sense whatsoever when I was watching it. So after I'd done the reading up, it was like, absolutely fantastic. And don't get me wrong, it's still terrible and it's only going to get 4 out of 10, but it's just, it pushed itself up a little bit. It pulled itself up by its bootstraps by just knowing that it was crap. I think it deserves a little bit of credit for that. Sue me, but I think it does.
I'm just looking through the cast list on IMDb. And
yes, sir.
Mimi Rogers is in it as well, Tom Cruise's ex-wife.
Yes, she is, yeah.
And there's an actor called Clement von Frankenstein.
Yeah, he was great.
I'll leave that there.
I honestly, it's really strange because I'm not recommending it to anyone, but... it surprised me of how shit, but how well it knew it was shit enough to take the piss out of itself, basically. And it, yeah, and so as I said, it's only, I'm not even going to give it a comedy rating. It's just a 4 out of 10. But if you do ever fancy seeing Amy Adams in a threesome as well, by the way, she gets off with a girl in this, which was, you know, not a pleasant, not an unpleasant way to end the film, but, you know, that was fine.
It gives you a happy ending, do you think?
It gave me a huge happy ending because it was Amy Adams. So, yeah, Cruel Intentions 2. Don't go and see it, but give it a chance, which is weird, but, yeah, there you go. I'm never going to live that one down, am I? I was bored, leave me alone. You should see Stephen's face right now. He's disgusted with me. Right, move on to the first film that we all watched.
And now, our feature presentation.
Okay, we move on come to the 1989 movie, and I'm only saying this full title once because it's an absolute pisser. We go on to The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, directed by Peter Greenaway, starring Richard Boringer, Michael Gambon, Helen Mirren, Tim Roth in there, a couple of other famous British actors. I think Roger Lipak showed up at one point as well. So, yeah, there's a great cast there, and the story is the wife of an oafish restaurant owner becomes bored with her husband and considers an affair with a regular patron. Now, I know three of us had seen this before, and I know one of us who haven't seen it before. So I think, if you don't mind, gentlemen, that that's going to be the perfect place to start with this one.
I would say that's a really good idea.
Yep. Scotland, you up for letting Charles have a go?
More than happy with that one.
Excellent. Charlie, would you like to kick us off on this one, sir?
Right. Don't really know where to start with this film. But
That's just watching it.
I'm really glad that I'm reviewing it on your show, because it gave me a similar experience to watching Irreversible, in that the beginning of it is so intense that it sort of suggests that the film's not only going to be a bit pompous, but it's going to be physically challenging to actually sit and watch. Although it does simmer down after that a bit, but it never really gets to a point where you're able to relax and assess or make sense of what you've just witnessed. It's, I think I've heard it described as an assault on the senses, and I think that's a really accurate kind of summary of what the film is. But no amount of preparation could really help with this. It was just a very demanding watch, and I think like the big thing for me is I've never witnessed a film that manages to be so grotesque and yet so resplendent at the same time.
I can't disagree with anything you said there, mate. Again, it's another one of those hard to describe films, you know, where you can actually say you enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in one moment you've got people feasting like lavishly and luxuriously, and then in the next instance you're faced with images of like rotting meat and violence, and almost like this quite post-apocalyptic looking environment. It was like basically a big version of the studio from Robot Wars. it's so difficult to really assess, because like reading up about it as well, there's a lot of talk that there is real political content in the film. It was at the time of a lot of people feeling genuine anger over the poll tax and Thatcher. Personally, I just took it at face value, because I think it was demanding enough to do that.
It is a very, very demanding film in many different ways, I think. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah,
certainly. I mean, there are films that I've watched that I've found more uncomfortable than this, but they're usually films that are defined by like one particular image or scene or trope. But with this film, and I'm not going to say the full title because you're right in what you say, they either display or reference just about everything revolting that the mind can conceive, basically. So you've got decay, you've got defecation, you've got rape, you've got murder, you've got sexual deviance. It's just an absolute tour de force of filth.
I think that should be on the cover. It's all the force of filth.
Yeah.
Should be the tagline for our podcast.
No, that's the idea of that for when you review Salo.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the weird thing about this, it's like Salo in that regard, that it's absolutely disgusting and a very visceral film, but you feel like it's still saying something. None of it's gratuitous, and there is actually a point to it rather than just, you know, being exploitative or over the top. But I think I wasn't entirely sure what that message was, but there is definitely something in there.
Yeah, couldn't disagree with that. So we'll move it over to Stephen. What are your thoughts on the film we're talking about?
The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
That's the one.
Well, I think Charles has made some very salient points there about it. It is a film that on the face of it, at first viewing, can be seen as being quite a debauched mess. And like you say, it's very much tying into all sorts of levels of filth and different facets of that, and how with the money and the lack of social mores that binds you, people's behaviour can plummet down to that level without actually having the culture to back up how to actually behave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are the definite things. It's a theatrical piece, very much, you know, the way it takes place. I mean, it presents a lot of its action from just one side that you're viewing, like an audience watching a play.
Mm-hmm.
But it does actually have lots of action in it, so it's not a static piece, and in actual fact it's very linear in the way it moves from scene to scene, literally moving from one room next door to another room. Which I think that, along with the fact that the use of colours to augment the feeling and the differentiation between each room, I think does actually make it a tableau in an artistic sense. It's quite painterly in that way, but I suppose more in a Francis Bacon form of painting rather than a Constable. So I think, that, you know, because you've even got the changing in aspects of the carried costumes. Mm-hmm. Different elements of them will actually change colour as they walk through to the next room,
yeah.
Which is sometimes subtle and sometimes it is incredibly obvious. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is gimmicky. I think that is actually bringing a lot of point to the viewer without it being something that's easily to be dismissed. I mean, the costuming, it does bring an element to it that it means that this leaves a historical context in some ways, because you can see it, like Charles said, about it being possibly post-apocalyptic in some senses with the way it is, because it's taking elements of fashion from revolutionary France and things, as well as things from the 1980s and more, you know, in that sense, putting the two together, and that clash of fashion styles sort of thing is what you know a lot of people see happening in your post-apocalyptic worlds. You get all this decadence in that sense and people just reinventing things. If you take away the appearance of the actual vehicles out in the street, which is a very small part of the film that you see them, mm-hmm. If you take them out, it really does defy a time frame historically, really. It could be set, you know, 50 years ago. It could be set in 200 years, yeah. Sort of thing.
Could be medieval, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and like Charles says about the banqueting being very visceral and stomach-churning almost, in the animalistically eating the way and gorging the way through, and then you're seeing the rotting fish and meat juxtaposed with that. And it's almost like you're going from one end of these scenes to the other, with the bathroom and the actual eating area, the kitchens and the street where the meat's coming from. It's almost like an intestinal tract, really, of the process of consumption, really. The acting in it was really good by and large, particularly from the main characters of Helen Mirren and Michael Gambon, mm-hmm. who obviously put in an emboldened performance because of the theatricalness of the actual film. But without it being over the top and lampoonish, there were still subtleties in there mm-hmm. that you can watch for and appreciate. I did actually feel that there was a bit of weakness in the Alan Howard character of the lover.
Right.
I think that was more to do with what he had to deal with as the character. I don't think as fleshed out as the other characters. It was there as a side, really, despite being in the title. It wasn't given as much detail as the others were and as much play. He's known to be a fantastic actor, is Alan Howard, and not many films, really, in his resume, mostly theatre work. But yeah, I think like that part was a bit lacking. But otherwise, I think the rest of them, as opposition to each other, there was, you know, he was the book learning. There was the cook in the title who was actually cultured to be able to express this, the mores and the style that actually Michael Gambon's thief wanted to be able to pretend to, but it was obvious from whenever he opened his mouth and tried to actually speak about culture and history and actually try to pontificate about that, he showed his weakness in that.
Of course.
Same as whenever he tried to show his power as the manager of this restaurant and all this kind of stuff, the more he tried to exert that power, the more he showed his actual weakness and inability. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you say the other characters that you're cropping up in there, you've got Tim Roth and Alex Kingston and Roger Lloyd Pike and stuff cropping up in bit parts in it, and they were interesting to see in the reference point of going, you know, what they went on to do, but it was very much centered around the main four characters, yeah. Which befits them being in the title, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The music was very befitting, I felt, and actually felt very much a soundscape to actually back up this decadence that was being displayed. Because the decadence actually, you know, seems to be, like Charlie said, it is an idea that it's referencing the deplorable yuppie excess, the nouveau riche element that at the time was the yuppies in the Thatcherite era, but has cropped up forever. There's always a new rich part of society who are looked down upon and who don't actually have the culture to handle this new money that they've got and end up doing deplorable acts and treating other people appallingly who are sometimes from their own background. But as a film, it is not an easy watch. It's heavily stylized, and although it's got moments that are quite difficult to digest in a number of ways,
oh, yeah.
to tie into the theme of the film, I mean, we don't want to be too pretentious usually when we're talking about films, but if you treat it as an artistic expression in film, I think it's it's a masterpiece, really.
Well said, well said. Scott, let's have your opinion, please, sir.
Well, I don't think I can add anything to that. Bloody hell.
I know, he does go off. Sorry, we can edit, it's fine.
Just say some of the same things again and I'll take out me saying it. That's what I usually
do with
smoking. That's true.
Well, it was the third watch for me, first time in about 20 years, and on this massive screen for the first time as well, as we said. I became a bit of a Peter Greenaway fan around about this time, the early 90s. I was working in the video store at the time, so I had access to all his movies. And you've got to remember, this is the sort of time when... Can you remember the early days of Channel 4 when it was a bit more edgy and its programming was a lot more hard? And they would champion people like Peter Greenaway or Derek Jarman, people like that. And these movies would be, I think, deliberately placed on primetime Channel 4 just to get the Merry White House Brigade up in arms. And I discovered a lot of his stuff through Channel 4 back in the late 80s, early 90s. This time round, I mean, because there's been quite a significant gap in my watches, that word enjoy, I'm going to use it here. I had a fantastic time with this movie last night. I loved every second of it again. The best.
Well, of course you did, because Helen Mirren's tits were as big as your head.
It was incredible. I've forgotten how naked, how often she was in this movie.
And how delicious she looks naked as well, I would say. In my opinion.
All feather hats and no knickers. It was brilliant. The best thing for me, apart from Helen Mirren's arse, being colourblind, the cinematography and that use of colour that you guys have already spoken about. Peter Greenaway and the cinematographer, who's a fantastic guy, is called Sacha Vierney, and he worked on a lot of Louis Buñuel stuff. He was the director of photography on Belle de Jour and things like that. They colour coded the movie specifically for me. It was fantastic. It was as if they'd actually known that I was colourblind and then think, let's make this a little bit easier for Scott. You know, they're walking into a different they're going into a different room here. Let's make the bathroom nice and bright for him, but then we'll have all the reds in the dining room and stuff like that. And quite rightly, someone has mentioned, like you did, Stephen, that that long tracking shot going from kitchen through to dining room through to the bathroom. And I know Smokey doesn't like looking into deep hidden meanings in things, but that was supposed to represent the passage of food through the alimentary canal.
Oh, wait, yeah.
It's not that I don't like it. It's just that I think it sometimes gets a little bit pretentious for my life.
Yeah, it's hard not to see that fluid motion of the camera. Because of the whole setup of the set itself, it is, like you said, quite warehousey, almost like one massive theatre. Even the external shots, you can tell it is one huge, massive soundstage. That external shot isn't done externally, is it? That has got to be indoors.
Yeah.
And the theatrical aspect of it as well. I like the fact that towards the end, without giving the ending away, where Helen Mirren is having that conversation with the cook at the table, asking him this particular question, the camera would then cut back to a long shot, and it would be perfectly framed as if he was watching it on a stage. It was just fantastic use of cinematography, as I say, and the colour coding for me was brilliant. The clothing as well, Jean-Paul Gaultier, we haven't mentioned, was the clothes designer, I believe, for this.
Right.
Yes, that would explain the French revolutionary influence in it, I suppose. And
the clothing was matching that massive great painting on the back wall as well, with the use of sashes and boots and things and frill collars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I do want to mention, because I thought Charlie would have done it, his little bit at the beginning, the singing child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about that after I'd done mine, but yeah, what do you think?
Well, my comment to Charlie before we came on air was it was like Alec Jones had stuck his cock in an electric socket. It was just so...
I thought it was Toya Wilcox.
If it had been, I think I probably would have enjoyed that a little bit more.
I can't see the reason for him being there. Obviously, it's artistic license.
I would say.
I thought it's because where it was kind of like a Jacobean sort of play. I don't know enough about that to really say, but I wondered whether there was a parallel with those sort of plays. There would be like a character, like there'd be the court jester, and then there'd be like the kitchen lad or something. And I thought he might have just been like a device of some sort.
Yeah, I'd not considered that, but I think that's a very accurate assumption, to be honest. That would fit entirely with it, and it's not something that occurred to me.
Yeah, he wasn't used as, like, say, a chorus is used in a Greek play, or you have the narrator in a Shakespeare play, don't you, that sort of progresses the plot along. He wasn't used in that sense, but he was a pretty vital element of the whole thing when you watch the whole movie.
I think he was a representation of innocence as well. Like, he's the only one who hasn't been corrupted in any way.
Possibly,
I think I agree with you there, Charlie. I mean, from a purely simplistic point of view, if you don't want to view it as a piece of art, you can. But if you don't want to, then you could just view it as a technical device. Him singing that song constantly, you know, wash my face, blah, blah, blah. It's just glue. It's just scene glue to take you from one point to the other. If you're going to just take it from a technical standpoint, and if it's an art house experience that you're watching, then you're not just going to do a George Lucas and do a star wipe to the next scene, are you? Or, you know, a swing cut. So I mean, I don't know. You guys can either agree or disagree, but I think it is just a sort of a technical point of getting from one scene to the other, but sticking it in the sort of artistic void, if you will.
Why are you discussing a pretty young boy and talking about sticking it in voids?
Because I forgot we were recording at that moment.
Because he's a paedophile.
to the point, Charles, thank you.
Okay, anyway.
But you enjoyed seeing it again, though, Scott?
I loved it. I had a great time with this movie. I'm glad I'd left quite a long period of time between viewings, because I think you could tire of this quite easily if you watched it quite often. It is just too much there, sensory overload to take on board. Did anybody notice the kitchen as well? That in some scenes it was all like neat and ordered and everything was clinical, and, you know, there was the guy doing the chopping and the guy that was constantly making the sauces. But then in other scenes, when there was disruption going on in the dining room, the place was like gone to hell. It was like a medieval castle, you know. There was just like things going, you know, completely shit.
That was before Michael Gambon had even fucking smashed the place up as well. I know what you mean, but it didn't occur to me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure whether my memory is just playing tricks on me on that point, because I'd have to rewatch to be sure, but I don't know whether there's a deterioration generally in the tidiness and sort of utility of the kitchen as the film progresses. Things are unravelling and falling apart generally for all the various people involved in the plot, and also the restaurant itself, as Michael Gambon's character gets more and more control and actually lets his whim drive more and more people away from the actual clients from it. Mm-hmm. I know that happens, that you start to see less and less people in the actual restaurant as he gets more and more wild with his victimising of people in it. And I don't know whether the kitchen reflects that in a deterioration or whether it actually jumps about on that. I can't remember.
I call me simplistic viewer. I think it is just it's a very good way of showing him losing control of not just of his faculties, but just of the place that he is running.
Control of the situation, because it's not just the place that he is meant to be running, but also he's losing control of his woman in that sense. The respect of his cronies as well, because they start speaking up more and more in opposition to his idiocy.
No, that's excellent. I'll just throw in my two penny worth, because I think you've all pretty much covered it. But I love this. I love this film. For one, as Scott pointed out just a short while ago, who isn't really up on their sort of symbolism and metaphors and things like that, and not that I'm not up on them, it's just I don't really care for them. You could drive yourself insane watching this. You could read so much into this, but if you take it face value, it's a stunning piece of work. Absolutely fantastic. When I reviewed it, I think it's got to be a couple of years ago now, I reviewed it. It was a very early episode of ours. And I said about Gambon that he is a demonstrable cunt. I will now up that after this subsequent watch and say I think this is the most horrible cunt I've ever seen in a film.
Yeah. No,
you've watched Cruel Intentions too.
I've watched Cruel Intentions too, yeah. This is a tour de force performance from Gambon. He starts at the beginning of the film and he doesn't stop. Your only respite is when the wife and her lover together, or the cook and blah blah blah. That's the only break you get really from him flinging verbal shit into your ears. It doesn't quit.
And physical shit.
And physical shit. That's what I said. Yeah. And it's a barrage of noise and filth. And it's a mesmerizing performance because you don't, you certainly don't like the bloke. You certainly don't sympathize with him. But fuck me, did I just want to hear what he was going to say next.
Well, I think me and Charles identify him with him quite strongly.
Yeah, definitely.
The excess power lifestyles.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm sure you'll find people like this on the terraces of Millwall every weekend, but I'm
absolutely
sure it's
not. I was waiting for a reference in the film, to be honest. interesting that you mention how much of a cunt he is, because it reminded me of two other performances in different films. Firstly, Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast as Don Logan, but also, sorry for another David Lynch mention, but very much like Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet as well.
Yeah, I agree. It's a total disregard for anyone else's feelings and fuck it, I'll do what I want kind of thing. And to me, regardless of how much I hate the character, I couldn't stop watching. But it's interesting. You were saying, Stephen, about it being like a painting, it's art. It really is. So
well, I mean, I come from an art school background, so I'm probably more likely to be viewing it from that perspective than some other people.
Before you jumped in, I was just about to totally agree with you. Now I don't know anymore. it's a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Every time I've ever seen a Hieronymus Bosch painting or a Slayer album cover, it looks just like this film looks, and how do I put it? It's like a feast of shit for the eyes. And it's and for the ears as well. It's just for, I mean, if this film had smell-o-vision, I think I probably would have been sick. But it was just, it's an amazing.
It probably smells like sitting next to you.
Oh, it's pretty, well done for holding it in. But it's just, yeah, I absolutely adore it. Helen Mirren out as well. She's great. And as Scott said, very, very naked for a lot of the film. It's an absolute pleasure to watch. But yeah, I absolutely loved it. So we will go on to some ratings. Charlie, will you give us a rating for this, please, sir?
It's one of those films that the more I think about it, the more I want to elevate the rating. So I think I initially gave it a 4, but that was more a reflection of how uncomfortable I was whilst watching this brilliant film. I'm tempted to actually give it a perfect score because of the kind of psychological impact that it's had on me since I watched it. And you mentioned Michael Gambon. His performance alone makes it worthy of acclaim, I think. But also, any film that has Ian Dury in it as well deserves praise.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
True.
Yeah, so I'm probably going to say 4.5, close to perfect.
Excellent, excellent. Scott, what would you rate it, sir?
In your rating system, it's 9 sheep's bollocks out of 10.
Outstanding. Sir, how about you? What would you rate this?
Well, it's not a film that's for everybody. There'll be some people who couldn't enjoy this no matter what. But for anybody who has an open mind enough to be able to watch this, even if they didn't get the same amount from it as us, I would think that they would still recognise it as being a masterpiece in a sense. And therefore, unless you've got a particular aversion, I would say this is one that people should actively search out.
Yeah.
Maybe just a streaming service for it, but if you can pick it up on DVD, then I think it's one that if you purchased it, although you may, like Scott said, you might not be watching it regular, you would go back to it after a certain amount of time, even if it was a decade. But it's one I think that would sit in your collection, and I think we're all the type of people that sometimes we own DVDs or whatever purely for the purpose of being able to then lend it to other people proletize about it. So in that sense, I'd say, you know, if you're a fan of film, it's one you should own.
Well said. Yeah, again, can't really add much to that. I think it's a stunning piece of work, especially if you're a film, movie fan, movie buff, whatever you want to call it, need to get it watched because it's just an absolute joy and work of art. And as you know, it's a very hard watch, but God damn, is it rewarding. And I'm gonna have to go exactly the same as Scotland. This is a 9. This is a 9 sizzling penises out of 10 for me. So, yeah, absolutely, dear and valued listeners, get it fucking watched. Right, so we have a little change to regular programming now, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah, as this is a 2-part episode, the usual smoky spoilers is going to come in episode part 2 of this episode. Yeah. So we're going to revisit a game that was so popular, we've only played it once. that we played the last time we guested on the fabulous Stinking Paws podcast. And in the words of Charlie, that I smashed, if I remember right.
Really?
Yeah. Fucking beat its ass.
I won't take his word for many things.
Ooh. So, Scotland, what are we playing?
Yes, it's the long-awaited return of Cast of the Summer Wine.
Hey! Our biggest achievement was coming up with that name.
I think it probably was.
Do you know what? I've forgotten how to actually play it. Let's see if we can work this out. The rules of the game, chaps. I have chosen a selection of movies from the 2 years in question that we are reviewing. So 1989, The Cook, the Thief, the Wife and the Lover's Year. And the film we're reviewing in part two was from 2006.
Yep.
So we've got a selection of movies from those years. I'm going to start with you, Smokey. I've got 1 to 21 is your choice.
Okay.
And they're random, as for the years.
And
basically, all I'm going to do is give you the top three or four cast members as listed on IMDb and the year of the film, and you've got to name the movie.
Excellent. Cue the music and an image of men in a bath rolling down a hill. Okay.
That's for Yorkshire.
Oh, yes.
Smokey, 1 to 21, sir.
1 to 21. Number 6, please.
Number 6 is from 1989, and it stars Julia Roberts, Shirley MacLaine, Daryl Hannah, Dolly Parton, Sally Field.
I know that as well. It's the one with the cancer, isn't it? Still Magnolias?
It is Still Magnolias for a point.
Get in.
Charlie, I'll let you go second, mate. Can you give me a number between 1 and 21, not number 6?
I'm lucky for some. I will go 13.
13 is from 2006, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Matt Damon, Jack Nicholson.
That is The Departed.
It's The Departed for a point.
Right.
Stephen, any number, 1 and 21, not 6 and 13.
I'll go for number 4.
Number 4 is from 1989, starring Kevin Costner, James Earl Jones, Burt Lancaster and Ray Liotta.
No.
Oh. Now, did I throw this over for bonuses before?
I don't know my aunt.
So, who's that going to?
Right, so next on the list will be you, Smokey. You get first choice at that first bash.
And that is going to be Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams for a bonus point.
Oh, yeah.
Well done, sir. Well done indeed.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so that was number 4. Smokey, it is your turn, sir. So, 1 to 21, not 6, 13 or 4?
18.
18 is from 2006. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ving Rhames, Lawrence Fishburne, Tom Cruise.
That will be Mission Impossible 3.
It is indeed for a point. Charlie? Charlie? Yeah. Anything not including 6, 18, 13 or 4, sir?
I'll have 20, please.
Number 20 is from 2006, starring a fully clothed Helen Mirren, Michael Sheen, James Cromwell and Sylvia Sims.
Why? See, I was going to say Brighton Rock, but it's not, is it? Because that was Sam Riley. I'm going to say The Queen.
It is The Queen for a point. Well done.
Well done, Charlie.
Thank you.
Stephen, your question in this round, not including 6, 13, 4, 18 or 20.
I'll have number one.
Number one. It's from 1989. Starring Harrison Ford, Alison Doody, John Glover, Sean Connery.
Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail.
Ooh. Chaps, adjudicate.
That's what you said.
For a point.
Yeah, we'll leave that.
His Holy Grail was what they were crusading for. Yeah.
So at the end of two rounds, Smokey has 3 points, Charlie has two, Stephen has one. Okay.
See how this is going.
It's not over yet.
Okay, Smokey, give me a number, sir, between 1 and 21, not including 6, 13, 4, 18, 20, and 1.
12.
Number 12. It's from 1989. You'll get this, mate. It's Sylvester Stallone, Kurt Russell, Terry Hatcher.
Oh, I think that must be Tango and Cash.
It is Tango and Cash for a point. Charlie,
it's
you're...
It's a team game, isn't it?
Charlie, your question, sir.
Can I have number 8?
Number 8. Well, we've got quite a big cast list for this one for you, mate. It's from 1989. And the stars are Tom Cruise, Willem Dafoe, William Baldwin, Daniel Baldwin, Tom Berenger, Tom Sizemore. Do you want me to read those out again for
was
you, mate?
Was it Tom Cruise, the first name you said?
Yep, Tom Cruise, Willem Dafoe, William and Daniel Baldwin, Tom Berenger, and Tom Sizemore.
Was it born on the 4th of July?
Was born on the 4th of July, well done, mate, yeah.
Thanks.
Well done, mate.
Well,
I was struggling, mate.
Well done, yeah.
I've actually seen most of these, it's incredible.
Stephen, any number between 1 and 21, not 6, 13, 4, 18, 20, 1, 12, and 8.
I'll have seven.
Charlie's going to hate you for this one, mate. It stars, well, it's from 1989, and it stars Spike Lee, John Turturro, Danny Aiello.
Do the Right Thing?
It is Do the Right Thing.
Oh.
Charlie, I bet you...
I like Spike Lee films as well as Charlie, did you say? So we're even on that.
So that was question number 7. We'll do one more round, guys, okay?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Smokey, you can have 2, 3, 5, 9, 10, 11, 14, 15, 16, 17, 19, or 21, mate.
We'll go for number 10.
Number please. 10 is from 1989. Mm. Stars Tom Hanks, Carrie Fisher, Bruce Dern, and Corey Feldman.
That's The Burbs.
Well done, it is indeed The Burbs.
There you go.
Charlie, same numbers for you apart from number 10.
Have we had 21 yet?
21 hasn't gone, mate. Would you like 21?
Yes, please.
21 is from 2006. Starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Connelly, Jimon Hounsou, and Michael Sheen again.
Shutter Island?
Is not Shutter Island. I will throw that over to Stephen. 2006 movie, sir. Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Connelly, Jimon Hounsou, and Michael Sheen.
Beach,
is it? It is not The Beach. Smokey, would you like to steal that point?
I will, because and Stephen's going to kick himself as well, because this is a film we watched before we started recording the podcast. It was a practice movie. It was Blood Diamond.
It was Blood Diamond, 2006.
Yeah, theft.
Oh. Right,
it's called Bondage, Charles.
I've never seen it.
Well, make this the final question, Stephen. It's your choice, sir. Oh, no, that was you, wasn't it? Number 20.
No,
that was Charles's.
Right? That was Charlie. It is you then, Steve. Sorry, mate. Yeah. All falls apart of the last question. 2, 3, 5, 9, 11, 14, 15, 16, 17, 19. 17 is from 2006 as well. Judi Dench, Mads Mikkelsen, Daniel Craig.
Casino Royale.
It is Casino Royale for a point. So, at the end... at the end of Cast of the Summer Wine, for this episode, Stephen and Charlie both finished on 3 points. With a massive 6, the winner is Smokey.
Reigning supreme for another episode.
In the words of Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind, the game is faulted.
I can't help it. It's, you know.
No, well done.
You cheated by using knowledge.
Yeah, I cheated by knowing shit about films.
well done. I suspected that you might win again this time, actually, based on your last performance.
Thank you very much, sir. You are a fair loser. Well done.
Well, I'm surprised and emboldened by myself, to be honest, that I managed to draw with Charles, to be honest.
Well done.
I expected to come in a pitiful last.
Well, there you go. There's no last place then, is there? You're a joint second.
Yes.
So we can look on the bright side of that one.
Always looking at the
always looking at the bright side. Yeah. And a big hand there for our question master as well. Thank you very much, Scott. Yes. That was awesome.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
Yeah. So, dear and valued listeners, we're going to wrap this one up now, and we will be back for part two of episode 43. So, we'd just like to say thank you very much for joining us again, Scotland and Charles, but we will see you again very shortly.
Thank you for having us.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. So, for episode 43, part one of History of Misunderstanding, I have been Smokey.
And I've been Stephen.
And no matter what time of the day you're listening to us, I hope you have a kick-ass time.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Good. What time do we run it? Hour and a half.
Hour and a half. Yeah.
That's all right. It's not bad.
Cut down my overly long review of the film. Then.
I wanted to point at my watch, but I thought it'd be really rude. Oh dear. No, that was good. I'm really glad you enjoyed the film, though, Charlie.
Thanks for introducing it to me. I like this sort of trend of films that we do that are pretty uncomfortable, but you're rewarded ultimately. Sometimes you need to be pushed towards these films to actually sort of take the plunge, really. So, yeah, brilliant.
You need to be pushed towards a rape movie.
Yeah, although there's a disappointing lack of rape, to be honest.
It was more suggestive.
Not as disappointing below as the amount of rape in Stranger Than Fiction, but
it's only one rape movie in an episode, mate.
Yeah, but he was hoping Stranger Than Fiction was going to be it.
Oh, see Maggie Gyllenhaal getting raped over a counter.
No, he was hoping that Will Ferrell was going to do it to Dustin Hoffman.
And he started screaming like he does in Rain Man.
Oh shit!
Mrs. Robinson! definitely rape. It's rape, definitely rape.
Oh, keep that for the athletes, will you?
Still recording.
Good.